KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. On today's show, fighting over the crumbs in Sacramento, how ballot measures have tied the hands of state budget writers, and mixed messages on medical marijuana laws.
Until there's some confidence on the law enforcement side that only really ill people are getting this and real doctors are making those decisions, there's going to be a tension and a suspicion here.
Also, the corporate takeover that sparked an environmental war on the North Coast, concerns about preserving a collection of African-American art in Los Angeles, and wild mushroom lovers in Santa Cruz County.
I like to make a pear tart, little puff pastry, sliced pears, and then drizzle candy cap caramel sauce on the top, and it's really good.
It's the California Report, good with or without caramel sauce. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger spent much of the week recovering from last weekend's motorcycle accident and rehabilitating his political image. While submitting a new state budget with more money for popular programs, the governor said balancing the budget is harder than he thought it would be when he ran for governor. One thing that makes it hard, ballot measures that keep much of the state's revenues from being touched. Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers explains.
Imagine for a moment that you are disabled and you have only $812 a month to live on.
Rent, you know, costs a significant part of that. Medicine and medical supplies can take the rest of that for people with disabilities. It's just a very meager existence.
Teresa Favuzzi is executive director of the California Foundation for Independent Living Centers, and she worries things are unlikely to get better anytime soon. On Tuesday, Governor Schwarzenegger called for balancing the state budget in part with federal money that is supposed to go to elderly and disabled residents who receive Supplemental Security Insurance, or SSI. The federal government sent the money to California to help SSI recipients with increases in the cost of living. Schwarzenegger wants to spend the money on other state programs.
Folks who have the least amount of money are not getting a cost of living allowance. That makes a significant difference to them.
Health and welfare programs have increasingly become where state lawmakers balance the budget when revenues come up short. That's because most of the remaining state expenditures are virtually off limits, thanks to ballot initiatives over the last two decades that now protect money for everything from public schools to local government services. This week, Governor Schwarzenegger said those voter-approved decisions forced how much and where his new budget spends money.
Most of it is already predetermined. Most of the things, and more than 70% of the things, you have no choice. And then there is another big chunk, another 20%, which is education which you need to pay off, maintenance fee and all those things. So you really don't have that much leeway.
The single largest portion of the state budget is controlled by Proposition 98, approved by voters to protect public school funding. Voters also approved Proposition 42 to guarantee funding for transportation projects. And it was Arnold Schwarzenegger's first foray into politics that helped pass Proposition 49, an initiative to guarantee funding for after-school programs. This year will be the first time Prop 49 kicks in, costing the state an extra $428 million. Together, these three initiatives will predetermine how almost 44 cents of every dollar in the state's general fund will be spent. Oakland Democrat Don Parada is president pro tem of the state Senate.
It's virtually making it impossible to have an intelligent, thoughtful budget discussion in this building because so much of what we have to do has already been sanctioned by the voters in a different arena.
Some of these initiatives were written with an escape clause, a way for lawmakers to suspend the measure if needed to help balance the budget. But both the governor and various interest groups have begun advocating for what could be called a firewall around laws like Prop 98 and Prop 42 to keep them from ever again being suspended. Advocates for the poor and disabled, like Teresa Favuzzi, say that means social services programs, which have no voter-approved protections, will continue to get squeezed by budget items that do.
Somehow that just does not seem like a reasonable process, and I just wonder where are our societal values in doing that.
In fact, some lawmakers say if the governor really wants to leave a legacy of reform, he should endorse a full-scale revision of the California Constitution. That's where numerous interest groups have gotten voters to lock in specific spending without anyone stepping back to assess the overall impact. For the California Report, I'm John Myers in Sacramento.
This week, San Francisco became the 15th county to begin accepting applications for a new statewide medical marijuana identification card. The ID card is meant to offer patients traveling around the state with marijuana some protection from arrest. But as Sarah Varney reports, they may not be protected for a while.
A few minutes before the new medical marijuana office at San Francisco General Hospital opened, a half dozen patients were already lined up to apply for the new state ID card. Ginger Juarez drove an hour and a half from Stockton to apply for a card. Her skin is gray and spotted, her eyelids heavy. Ginger uses marijuana to fight the effects of her liver disease. She sits down in the cramped cubicle and hands her application across the desk.
You live in Stockton?
Yeah, I just recently moved.
We have a problem here, darling.
The state program establishes the same application process across all 58 counties. Medical marijuana patients can apply for the state photo ID card through their county of residence only. The county verifies that a doctor recommended marijuana and then sends the patient's photo and ID number to the state. Gregory Franklin of the California Department of Health Services oversees the new program.
Right now the law says that an individual can have up to 8 ounces and 6 immature plants. The statewide card allows an individual to be in possession of that amount at any given time, anywhere in the state. The card is recognized statewide. Prior to that, individual counties, they may have had medical marijuana registration programs, but those cards were only valid in those counties.
Back at San Francisco General, dozens of people from outside the city are showing up to apply for a card. The city has a reputation for leniency, so it's no wonder some of these people are confused. Under the previous city-run program, residents from 6 surrounding counties could get an ID card here, and it was widely understood that people from anywhere could easily come up with a local address.
It says you live in Laguna Beach?
Yes.
Okay, well, we don't service Laguna Beach.
You don't?
No, just San Francisco residents.
Oh.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Every county is supposed to start
Orange
its
County
own
doesn't.
Program.
Yeah, Orange County doesn't.
I don't really know what to tell you.
The short answer is there isn't a place to go in Orange County or in San Joaquin or Los Angeles or San Diego. In fact, only 15 counties have the program in place, and one county, San Diego, is not only refusing to implement the card system, it's planning to file suit to overturn the state's medical marijuana law altogether. So what happens if, say, tomorrow, a California Highway Patrol officer pulls over an Orange County resident carrying marijuana and a doctor's recommendation, but no state ID card? The law, which the state Supreme Court upheld 4 years ago, carves out immunity for patients who have a written or even oral recommendation from a doctor to use marijuana. Assemblymember Mark Leno from San Francisco says patients aren't actually required to carry the new state card.
Just imagining that someone would be required to have to get an identification card for a medicine which is recommended by a physician then encroaches upon civil liberties.
So what should happen if an officer pulls over someone who has medical marijuana and the doctor's recommendation?
The law enforcement officer needs to abide by the law. It's not for the law enforcement officer to second guess or doubt that any part of the process has not been according to law.
And until there's some confidence on the law enforcement side that only really ill people are getting this and real doctors are making those decisions, there's going to be a tension and a suspicion here.
UC Hastings criminal law professor Rory Little says law enforcement has plenty of reason to be suspicious. For example, no one knows the exact number of medical marijuana prescriptions written every year in California. And some top health officials agree that a few doctors are writing a large number of them, often for conditions that don't qualify as a serious illness. A CHP spokesman says every person who carries medical marijuana must have the state's new ID card, no exceptions, not even for residents who can't apply for the card because their county doesn't offer it. Vincent, who would only give his first name, lives in Riverside County. Even though it will take a month to get his new card, Vincent, who has cystic fibrosis, says the county sheriff cited him for possessing marijuana.
They just say that they have a new card in place, that you have to have this card, and if you don't have it, it's invalid. They take your physician statement, so you can't get into any of the medical clubs, and they take your cannabis, so you have no medication.
According to the California Department of Health Services, there is no deadline for counties to have their ID card program up and running and no penalty for noncompliance. So for the time being, medical marijuana patients in most California counties remain caught up in a disagreement between the officers who enforce the law and the legislators who wrote it. For the California Report, I'm Sarah Varney.
This week, we continue our look at Pacific Lumber, a company that's been cutting redwood trees on the North Coast for seven generations. 20 years ago, the family-run business was purchased by a Texas corporation, and now it sits on the brink of bankruptcy. Reporter Jason Margolis looks back at the contentious history and environmental battles of Pacific Lumber.
For decades, the owners of Pacific Lumber had cautiously managed their forests. By the 1980s, the company held the largest supply of virgin redwoods in private hands left remaining in the world. But when the company was bought out in 1985, practices around here changed. The new owners doubled the rate of logging. Around the time of the takeover, Mark Harris was a young environmental lawyer who had recently moved to Humboldt County. He starts the engine for his Cessna propeller plane and takes me on a guided tour over Pacific Lumber's 211,000 acres. He shouts over the roar of the engine while describing the landscape.
What I was seeing in 1988, 1989, in this entire drainage were just giant swaths of forest, just an unbroken chain in large part.
The old Pacific Lumber logs selectively. The new Pacific Lumber under Max Sam began clear cutting.
As we're flying in now, you can see that there's just been a colossal devastation directly in front of us. There may be some greenery, but on closer inspection, you see that's a lot of brush, baby trees, and not much else.
In the late 90s, the California Department of Forestry briefly suspended the company's license for repeated violations of timber laws. Harris says the intense logging took its toll. Today, sediment regularly clogs the rivers. Many of the great trees that once shaded waterways like Yager Creek, which flows into Humboldt Bay, are gone.
Now, Yager Creek temperatures are through the roof in the summertime. They cannot sustain in large part any type of fish, baby fish that are attempting to be protected. There's no tree cover.
Back on the ground, Tom Herman speaks from his office in downtown Eureka. Herman managed these forests through much of the 1990s and has worked in the timber industry on California's North Coast since the early 70s. Herman says the new owners took a sluggish company and did what any forester would do on commercial lands.
If you owned land that was occupied by old-growth timber, you should cut that first because timber in its old-growth state does not grow. It's at a state of equilibrium.
Herman says Pacific Lumber did what every other California timber company had already done decades before, and the company was unfairly targeted by environmentalists just because they had ancient trees left to cut. Herman no longer works for Pacific Lumber, but he says the company had a right to log. This is private land, he says, not a park.
You know, we were a corporation, and the corporation was set up to grow and harvest trees to make money, okay? So I'm not ashamed to say, yeah, that's our motivation. Now, our motivation to make profit, nobody ever communicated to me, we want you to break the law or be uncaring or damage the land or the environment to accomplish that. Never.
But environmental groups and many longtime local residents saw the increases in logging as a betrayal. Lawsuits quickly piled up. And a more radical environmental movement emerged as well. The group Earth First arrived on the scene. In 1990, roughly 2,000 environmental activists came to Northern California for a summer of civil disobedience. It became known as Redwood Summer. K-Mud community radio reporter Estelle Fennell covered the summer's events, which included regular police escorts of logging trucks.
What we've got here is a standoff because the police are not moving. Somebody is sitting on the ground. I imagine something's going to happen really soon because of that. People are stopping the police. The police are not moving. The police are not.
One of the leaders of Redwood Summer was Daryl Cherney. With his large, bushy beard and curly hair, Cherney became a familiar face in Humboldt County, playing his guitar and writing songs, trying, often in vain, to lure the lumberjacks onto his side.
Tell me, where are we gonna work when the trees are gone? Say, will the big boss have us wash his car, or maybe mow his lawn? I'm a man, I'm a man, I'm a lumberjack man, but I fear it ain't for long.
We based our campaign on Freedom Summer, which took place in the Deep South, Mississippi, and other southern states in the early 1960s, where Jim Crow laws and, you know, segregation were just going unchecked until the eyes of the nation were cast upon what was going on down there. And we felt that the eyes of the nation needed to be cast upon the Redwoods so that people could see what was happening behind the Redwood Curtain.
Then in May of 1990, as Cherney and co-organizer Judy Berry were on their way to Santa Cruz to promote Redwood Summer, an event nearly brought down the movement.
An explosion tore through a car being driven by two Earth First activists on an Oakland street today. Both are alive and have been hospitalized. Earth First activist Judy Berry was seriously hurt with facial injuries and a pelvic fracture. Daryl Cherney suffered lacerated eyes and ears. Both are at Highland Hospital.
Both survived the attack. To this day, nobody knows who planted the pipe bomb packed with nails. The two activists were initially held as suspects, accused of bombing themselves, perhaps to raise publicity. But they were never charged. Berry and Cherney turned around and successfully sued the FBI and Oakland police for false arrest and illegally searching their homes. Berry died in 1997 from breast cancer. Cherney is still active in the movement today, living among the redwoods of Humboldt County. But the protests have diminished in intensity. After Redwood Summer, environmentalists found a new cause to rally behind, and Pacific Lumber went to the courts to defend their right to log. For the California Report, I'm Jason Margolis in Humboldt County.
Next week, Pacific Lumber's highly contentious Headwaters Forest deal and the fight to save a grove of ancient redwoods. For more than two decades, William Paggio collected the work of African-American artists for the Golden State Mutual Life Insurance Company in Los Angeles. Paggio is now 80 years old, and the collection of more than 250 paintings, drawings, and sculptures is considered one of the most important of its kind in the nation. As KPCC's Adolfo Guzman-Lopez reports, now there's concern about the collection's future.
For the past 55 years, the building on the northeast corner of Western and Adams in L.A. has loomed large in the local history of African Americans.
You're in the lobby of Golden State Mutual Life.
That's William Paggio, the company's former art director, on a recent visit. Starting in 1925, Golden State sold life insurance to blacks when most others refused. The surrounding community was proud of the black-owned business. And in 1965, Golden State set out to build a collection of African-American art that would embody the community's progress. Paggio became the curator and was given a $5,000 yearly budget. Some of the artwork is still in the lobby.
You're looking at a drawing called General Moses, done by Charles White.
It's a 6-foot by 4-foot ink portrait of Harriet Tubman. The liberator of black slaves is portrayed in her late 20s, young but weary, sitting on a bench carved into a boulder.
This is a piece that everybody would love to have. I would love to have it myself, but I have no real wall space for it.
Now, you say you bring all black artists that you know of here. Why is that, to see this painting?
To see this painting. They all want to see it.
Why?
It's the greatest drawing in the history of black art, as far as we're concerned.
And it's valuable, too. Paggio says it's worth at least $250,000. Okay. On the second floor, he stops at one of his own pieces.
I didn't start painting black until 1965.
What do you mean?
I mean, I did these kind of things for years.
This is a watercolor with a deer and some trees.
Yeah.
And
that's the kind of thing I did, but after the 65... And after John Riddle, I felt that I had to draw my people.
Artist John Riddle took Paggio on a tour of Watts after the 1965 riots. Paggio abandoned landscapes and painted black street life, portraits, and jazz musicians from his native New Orleans. Paggio stops in the cafeteria to admire a John Scott print called Jonah and the Whale.
I think black artists feel almost like Jonah and the Whale. They are caught up in something that they can't get out of. This is what black art is all about. That's it.
Are you worried about this collection?
I'm worried about it may be lost. to the black community.
What do you mean?
See, nobody's here to take care of it. This is not tops on anybody's priority.
Back in the lobby, company spokeswoman Becky Ganther says Golden State is committed to the art collection.
We are preserving it and keeping it up, and actually we're working, and we've done a lot to bring a lot of some of the most important pieces here in the lobby that you can see, because as you can see, it's on throughout all five floors.
Ganther says Golden State won't sell the art because it's become part of the company's identity. But she also says Golden State has ordered an appraisal to determine, for the first time, its fair market value. Several art curators say that could lead to the sale of the collection.
I think that would be a cultural tragedy of unmitigated proportions, and I'm using my language very carefully here.
Paul von Blum is a professor of African American Studies at UCLA.
That collection is magnificent. It must stay intact.
Von Blum says the California African American Museum in LA would be the best place for the art. The museum's curators have cataloged the artwork and say it's in good condition. Charmaine Jefferson, the executive director, won't say whether the museum has approached the company to acquire the collection. The 250 works of art, she says, are an important historical document for everyone, not just blacks.
200 years from now, what will the people know about who we are but through our art? If the only art we have is that which is put out commercially, we're in trouble, because everybody will think that the only thing we liked was half-dressed women dancing on a video.
Golden State Mutual agrees it's an important collection, and to that end, the company wants more people to come admire the work in the building's lobby. For the California Report, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez in Los Angeles.
Mushroom fans will be sprouting up all over Santa Cruz this weekend for the 23rd annual Fungus Fair. While eating candied mushroom cookies and sipping mushroom soup, fungophiles will learn how to identify wild mushrooms and turn them into gourmet treats. Reporter Amy Coombs got some early samples.
This time of year, the soggy Santa Cruz redwood forests are ablaze with bright crimson and orange mushrooms. Debbie Johnson, a fungus festival organizer, is harvesting wild fungi to display at the festival. She darts around a tree trunk coated with translucent teardrop-shaped mushrooms and stoops to collect a batch of copper-colored caps from the forest floor.
This is a candy cap. It's a large one. It's kind of a cinnamony brown color. If you smell it, ultimately, when this is dried, it's going to smell kind of like maple syrup.
Candy caps can only be found in Northern California and Southern Oregon. And at $125 a pound, Johnson says the sweet-flavored mushrooms are a lucky find.
They're really nice in a caramel sauce. I like to make a pear tart, little puff pastry, sliced pears, and then drizzle candy cap caramel sauce on the top, and it's really good.
There are over 3,000 different mushroom species found in California, but only about 100 are edible, and few taste as good as candy caps. But like many tasty mushrooms, candy caps look very similar to poisonous species, so Johnson says foragers really have to know what they're looking for.
If you look underneath, it has, you know, kind of the usual gills, and when we cut the gills, milk will come out. This group of mushrooms are called milky caps. Lactarius is the name, and they literally lactate.
It takes a variety of factors to identify an edible treat. And after unearthing a poisonous look-alike just a few feet from where mushroom hunters found the candy caps, Phil Carpenter warns you can't identify a mushroom by cap color alone.
You'll notice that there's a difference in the coloration of the gills. You'll also notice the stem is very fibrous, whereas the stem of the candy cap breaks like a piece of chalk. It's very brittle, it's fragile.
Armed with a straw basket and a digging spade, Carpenter demonstrates the difference between edible and non-edible mushrooms during a guided taste testing session. The Fungus Federation coordinator asked Lisa Akeson, a budding fungi connoisseur, to sample a tiny portion of a russula mushroom. Only some russulas are edible, and if the cap tastes like cayenne pepper, it means it's not safe to eat.
This is called Russula silvicola. And you can see how white the gills are, how close they are, the red cap, the white stem. And why don't you take a bite of this, chew it up just a little bit.
Oh, my. It's really hot, and it has a chemically kind of feel on the palate.
Carpenter says the best way to prevent such a tongue-numbing experience is to avoid eating unidentified mushrooms altogether. Because the most poisonous mushrooms in the world, Amanita flores, or death caps, grow in the Santa Cruz Mountains, he says it's better to be safe than dead.
If you're picking a mushroom and you think you know what it is, but you're not sure, then take it to someone that, you know, can identify it and someone you trust with your life.
Fungi experts will be on call at the Loudon Nilsen Community Center in Santa Cruz this weekend for the annual Fungus Festival. There will be plenty of opportunities to sample exotic varieties of mushrooms and admire displays of local foraged fungi. For the California Report, I'm Amy Coombs.
And that's the California Report for this week, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Seal Muller is the technical producer. We had additional engineering from Paul Lancour, Danny Bringer, and Howard Gelman. Our interns are Dana Lehman and Elizabeth Minnelli. Our producers are Victoria Mullione and Erica Kelly. The editor is Kat Snow. Ingrid Becker is our senior producer. Susan Kennedy is our managing editor. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, committed to improving California's healthcare delivery and financing systems, on the web at chcf.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California. TIAA CREF, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good. TIAA-CREF.org. Charitable Auto Resources, a full-service vehicle donation program management firm, which helps nonprofit organizations increase their revenue. Online at charitableautoresources.com. And the Stewart Foundation, for coverage of important issues in public education.